Welcome to Syncopate. I'm Dr. Michelle S. Johnson, aka DJ Disobedience. This documentary series pursues the syncopation of culture, that groove just on the other side of the beat, and brings together education, social science, arts, culture, history, science, and cultural production. It'll bring in health, humanities, philosophy, and people's lives. Each show starts with a curiosity I have about a cultural expression. As I've traveled paths of thought and land, I still wonder about aspects of American Black history, especially in the Midwest. Whether it's from the perspective of a DJ, an American culture PhD, or the kid who just loves social studies and now knows about Zora Neale Hurston, listeners can pop in on instructive conversations about Black movements and spaces, especially in Michigan. I most always start with my very cool and knowledgeable friends and family. My people are variously degreed, informally and informally trained in the ways of the world. Welcome to our side of the beat. My path of curiosity and storytelling is a long and complicated one, from my earliest homes in Kalamazoo, Chicago, and Saginaw to this computer and microphone. I laid stepstones with the first Panasonic tape recorder when I was 9 or 10 and formalized my interest over the years visiting libraries, archives, kitchen tables, and porches, especially in Michigan, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and following Zora Neale Hurston's geographic and cultural maps in Florida. In Syncopate's Raising Hay and Planting Roots, Black farmers in Kalamazoo, Cass, and Van Buren counties, each episode shows how family story frames Black environmental culture with the history of Black agricultural land ownership, art, oral history, and current cultural movements. Raising Hay especially digs through layers of pride and the challenges of Black farmers and rural residents who owned or have agricultural enterprises. In four episodes, we will explore the life and art of four Black women artists, Lindsay Kelly, Selena Johnson, Heather Mitchell, and Remy Harrington, as they reveal the links between creativity, identity, land, farming, and legacy. These moments piece together before, during, and since the massive pandemic in broad-based Black activism in the United States seem even more relevant as we recall what is deemed essential and our narrator's insight on environmental culture, ancestry, retention, loss, and restoration. Kalamazoo is a center of incredible creativity and talent in the arts, and Black women significantly shape excellent productions in theater, music, dance, poetry, and visual art. A child of a visual artist and a musician, I have been lucky enough to make spaces for Michigan artists for three decades now and have seen the transformative, healing, and restorative effects of the arts on multi-generational audiences, artists, and social economic systems. Like all the women in Raising Hay, Remy Harrington is one of those creatives. Life, beauty, and the stuff of creation fill her visual art, writing, activism, and work in urban agriculture.
My mother was a military officer. She was a major in the United States Air Force, and so she retired when I was in high school at Langley Air Force Base in Hampton, Virginia. But prior to that, I say that I'm from Virginia because I lived there the longest and I graduated from high school there, but I was born in California to Pennsylvania in Chester. It's right outside of Philly. Then we moved to Ohio. I went to elementary school there, and then I moved to Okinawa, Japan. And I went to 6th, 7th, and 8th grade there on Kadena Air Force Base. And then we moved to Virginia. And so I lived a lot of places and a lot of travel in between all of that. I have traveled extensively throughout Asia and I've been a lot of places. When I came to Michigan, I came here as an adult. I transferred from Virginia State University to Western. Then I moved to Florida and lived there for 2 years. And then I came back to Michigan. And so I've been here ever since. As it relates to my experience with food, living that kind of way has opened up my palate to a really diverse palette because of just the way that my lifestyle was very transient. I had a lot of different school experiences and I met a lot of different types of people. And so as a result, diet and food and culture is all a component of what all of that represents. How you source your food obviously is an important component of that conversation. I spent a lot of time specifically in Virginia. I went to Virginia State in Petersburg, Virginia, living in the Hampton Roads area and going to a school that had a focus in on agrarian culture and that has these deep ties to the transatlantic slave trade, that just was of the James River. I mean, all of that conversation was something that was just normalized in the context of what an experience is for a Black person living in Hampton Roads and living in Virginia. Historically, going on the tours, the Southampton Nat Turner tours, and all of those layers of history and context surrounding food and the sustainability of Black culture and what our people represent. Very early on, it was made very clear to me the importance of growing and sourcing your own food because of the role that segregation played in living in the South and what my grandparents' experiences were. My mom is from Toledo, Ohio, so my mom would be a native Midwesterner, but my grandfather was from Missouri and my grandmother was from Memphis, Tennessee. And my grandfather's parents were sharecroppers. And my grandmother, she actually came from a middle-class family. She was AME and she was a nurse. My grandfather's parents were sharecroppers. I'm just thinking about all the ways that food and farming and culture play a role in what my palate is now. Like, I have a taste for chitlins. Like, I will eat that. I mean, my palate varies. I eat kimchi. I eat bulgogi. I eat hot Cheetos. I eat a lot of different things. Seafood, because I lived on the water. I don't know. I just have a lot of different, I have an appreciation for a lot of different things because of just the way I was raised. And yeah, I can't hate it. It's just who I am.
I love how you're expressing that and how all of these things intertwine with space and place and identity and history and movement and autonomy, how all of those coalesce in your experience. So it sounds like in some ways you came to some level of consciousness in Ohio. Would that be the case?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
What was, and your mom was from Toledo, that's where she was. She born there and raised.
She was born there. Yep, born and raised in Toledo, mm-hmm. Ohio. Yep.
Now, your grandfather was a sharecropper. Did they do any gardening or anything like that in Toledo?
Sure, his parents were sharecroppers, and absolutely, my grandfather, to this day, you can see the remnants of his garden. And he always had a garden, always. I mean, he would grow watermelon. I said pineapple. He would grow watermelon and we could smell it and he would cut it and we would just rush because we were just amazed that my grandfather could grow a watermelon on the side of my grandparents' house. The home that they purchased, they were the second Black family to move into that neighborhood that they moved in. And my grandfather, he passed when he was 89 years old, and he worked up until the point that he passed away. He worked so hard. He retired from at least two or three different jobs. He just worked, and he grew food. I mean, he absolutely did. And the cousins, all of us, we just loved it. And there, one thing that is very prevalent in my mind about my experience with growing is that I used to run in the yard a lot, and there's like these woods behind my grandparents' house. My grandfather has passed, but my grandmother's still alive. She's 93. But there was this, I mean, there's so much poison ivy back there. And my family would be like, I'm a wild one. So I'm always doing flips and look, I could do a back walkover and I could do this. They'd be like, Remy, get out the grass, get out the woods, sit down. And I'd be like, no, I could do this. And then I have poison ivy all on me, Michelle. Like, it's just a mess, but very clear stories of my grandparents growing in like yard and woods and just nature that I had exposures to from very early on in my life.
Something going on, I feel funny, can't tell me nothing different. My nose twitching, intuition setting in like Steve Vision. I still close my eyes, I still see visions. Still hear that voice in the back of my mind. So what I do, I still take heed, I still listen. I still paint that perfect picture. I still shine bright like a prism. My words still skipping. I know you can't, don't, won't get it. You chose to ride that ship, salt with it. I'm still afloat, I ain't the captain of the yacht.
Remy and I reconnected at a Racial Equity in the Food System Summit in 2019. She had exhibited years before as a visual artist and performed poetry at FIRE, the arts and cultural nonprofit I co-founded in Kalamazoo. I knew loosely of her work in urban agriculture and the arts, and as these things usually go, I bumped into her again at a dear friend's master's graduation party and learned about her navigation of her initiative, Urban Folk Art Exploratory, while directing a high-profile project that provided participants with avenues to land access through ownership as a tool to dismantle intergenerational poverty. Harrington's project included many key players and was seeking Black farmers and their stories. I'd created my first pilot of Syncopate, and then, in what turns out to be the season of Yes, the Arts Council of Kalamazoo announced their recent Emerging Artist Grant.
You mentioned cousins. Would you all, so I'm interested in these woods. What was, did you spend time in the woods, or was the poison ivy the secret barrier between you and the deep recesses of the forest?
So to me, like if you came to our house, it's on Rosedale Avenue in Toledo. First of all, it's on a city block. Like it's like, it now, to me, this place felt so magical. The woods felt so big. But it's not woods, like it's trees. Like it's trees. There's probably like a big group of trees that like separate my grandparents' like yard from like these apartment buildings behind it. But it felt so big to me, and it felt like this place that where we just explore. It felt like the woods, and it was like we would explore in these. I mean, it felt so big, this insurmountable yard. And it's like when you go there now, you're like, I mean, it's not that big of a yard. It's not, but it was the woods. It was it was like, I'm exploring, and because I was so little. It felt like that. You got to come with me one day. You're going to be like, Remy.
I would love to see it.
You got to. But yes, that's what.
and was that big, part? Oh, go ahead.
Uh-huh. No, that's it. Go ahead.
No, I want to hear more how it looks.
No, there's a fence behind it, and you can see it now, but I couldn't see it then. I just saw the trees, and now it just feels like a neighborhood, you know? And back then, to me, I felt like I was like Anne of Green Gables or something. I don't know.
Now, has it grown? How long were your grandparents there?
All my life.
Has it changed over time? I mean, yeah, tell me some more about that.
Oh my goodness. Well, like I mentioned, my grandparents were the second family to move into that house. My grandparents had seven children between them. And like, my Aunt Roxanne, who's only 12 years older than me, she was the only one that was really like raised up in this house. The rest of them were raised in a house on, I want to call it Door Street. I think it's Door Street.
And tell me about that, a little bit more about in your art. So you talked about the images of Black women in art. Can you tell a little bit more about maybe some of your pieces and some of your work?
Sure. I did a piece. I just try to capture the images of like what I think is beautiful. I think the earth is beautiful. I think Black women are beautiful. I did one of my very early on exhibits. I used to own an art gallery in Battle Creek, and one of my very early exhibits, I called it Mother Earth, and it was of a woman who was my mom's sorority sister. Her name was Mae Dinkins, and she was a beautiful Black woman. She passed away. She's an octogenarian, and she had these gorgeous, beautiful bone structure. Her nose, her everything. And I just took a picture of her and I digitally edited. And I put her hair in this, like she had the most beautiful silver hair. And I combed it up and I put it into a in a ball on the top of her head, and I just like made her look like she just, it's a beautiful picture. I love it. And I took pictures of women like at varying stages in their life. I had a woman in her 50s and everybody was nude. I did a woman in their 50s and I did two young girls in their 20s. And so like just the gorgeous, like how beautiful our bodies are, like, and it was like from here up, like from like in your 20s up to your 80s, like you could still be like, just look at, this is picturesque. This is like art. This is gorgeous. And I did an exhibit and I love it. Like, I don't know. I just love capturing like what I think is beautiful and telling the story the way, I mean, like even the book that I wrote, The Delicious Trauma of Black Love, like the images in the book, there's breasts, there's penises, there's land, there's blood, there's semen, there's all the things that, I mean, all of this stuff that I do is telling the story of creation over and over and over and over again, life over and over and over and over again, what I think is beautiful over and over and over again, and all the different layers in between. That's what I'm always, having a baby, a birthing pose, so all my stuff is like that. So that's what you can expect from Remy Harrington. All my art is going to be some stuff like that. Like, oh gosh, black women again, yup. Every single time, yup. Something with the earth, yup, Remy. This symbolizes, yup, every single time. It's just what I like. I can't, it's the images in my head.
what's your most current image that's in your head to come to, like, what kind of art is in your head right now?
Well, right now it's a lot of words. Like I am, like I was saying earlier, I don't know if I ever landed that point, but like I'm trying to, I'm writing a lot and I am trying to express like what my experiences have been in a way that feels poetic and also feels like that captures like the experience that I had. And I have been having, trying to do work to advocate on behalf of people owning land as a Black woman. And I mean, I have been accused of crafting really long emails that like maybe not, that may or may not be getting what the point that I intend to convey across. And so if my emails are not being effective, then maybe a book will be. Maybe my book will be. Maybe if I add some pictures up in this boy for y'all, then maybe, and like I make a book or something, maybe that'll be palatable for the humans. But because my emails, my emails are not landing me the what I need them to land me. They're not getting me to the Z that I need to be at right now. So
maybe can you cut and paste some of your emails for your book?
Michelle, you ain't never lied. That is, I have thought about that as an idea. I was like, maybe this whole entire book need to be the emails. How's that? Now,
and then what's some pictures?
You're trying to get me in trouble. No,
nah, I'm just trying to help you be your full self.
Because that's what I really want to do. I don't want to write nothing else. I'm tired. I want to put it together. I want to staple that and mass and circulate the emails that I didn't send. I didn't wrote enough. That's what, that's what I really want to do. So thank you for that.
Another summer, sound of the funky drummer, music hit your heart, cause I know you got a soul. Hey, listen if you're missing y'all, swinging while I'm singing, giving what you're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating, in the rhythm I'm rolling, gotta give us what we want, gotta give us what we need.
Harrington's project included many key players, and she was seeking black farmers in their stories. I'd created my first pilot of Syncopate on Black resorts, and then, in what turns out to be the season of yes, the Arts Council of Kalamazoo announced their recent Emerging Artist Grant. I modified previous applications, and they granted me the lovely startup funds to produce the podcast episode that I imagined. And, as with much creative, one episode became four. In this episode of Raising Hay, we hear Remy reflect on the possibilities of Black people finding equitable solutions within and without established systems hindered by racialized power disparities, Black people's essential relationship to the land, family legacy, and art.
One thing I can tell you about with this question is that it has hurt my feelings that unless you get an endorsement from a major bureaucratic entity, it feels like in this community that you will be like chasing your own tail if you don't get some type of an endorsement or some type of a, you know, like funding stream or work within the context of what currently exists. It's like, it feels like I said, you're chasing your tail. So when I told you that with my active resistance and insistence with Tegan's Hopeful Storybook Garden and Farm, at that point it was Tegan's Hopeful Storybook Garden that I was trying to do. I had this multifaceted social enterprise in my head where this food business that I had was going to fuel the community development work that I did, which is the little farm school thing, you know, with the little activities that are in the garden. There's 54 interdisciplinary arts-based activities in this space. And I was going to teach my daughter and other kids in the community. The moms were going to do it, and blah, blah, blah. We had this vision. And I was going to do this, and I never could get any traction. And so I came to a major institution in this community, educational institution, and I asked them to sponsor my garden space because I felt like the only way that I was going to be able to get the type of mass buy-in that I needed for this concept to be sustainable, because I had been doing it for years by myself and I kept, you know, spinning my wheels, that the only way that I was going to be able to get this done was coming through an institution like this. And they had their own vision of creating this space that was going to be for sustainability. And so I thought it was a perfect union. When I went to them and asked them, they said, no, you know, not at this time. We're not interested in that. Years later, they hired me to come in and do this work, to be able to create community farms in this community and to recruit for that and to identify the need for community, for urban agriculture in the community and where that showed up. And so because I had done that and my project obviously had not scaled, I think that, I mean, I wasn't on the hiring committee, so I don't know what pushed me over the edge to be able to get the position, but I ultimately was able to secure the position. And I ended up working within this institutional space, and ultimately we separated ways. And that's the best way I can say that. But in my time there, I was insistent, just by virtue of the way that the grant funding within the context of the work internally and externally and with the stakeholding partners, they said that their focus was on creating farms to address intergenerational poverty. And so the only way that I knew to do that work with integrity was to center the face of what poverty represents, which in this community is Black women and their children. And so I was very emphatic about that being the approach that we took. Somehow things within the context of that entity and the bureaucracy of what that represented, it became very clear to me that there were barriers that were being put up purposefully for people to be able to access land and the resources that they needed. And the story surrounding how these people that I think are absolutely brilliant, brilliant people that have the same type of story that I have, that I just shared with you, varying levels of why they wanted to participate in agriculture and the interconnectedness of like how they just, I don't know, through osmosis have come up with, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is what I'm doing. They have those same, very, very same stories. I could not stomach the idea that somebody was going to be able to say that they came in and helped us because we, these poor, unfortunate, tragic Black folks that, you know, that's not the story. I didn't go out and recruit my people to come in and have that be the story to be told about our ability to access land. You know, and to, because y'all picked us up and you came and taught us, this is what we came to this country for. We came to this country and on our backs, we built the infrastructure on land of the indigenous peoples of this land. We I mean, our relationship with the land here is just very different than the beneficiaries of slave labor. And I wanted to have that conversation. I wanted us to think about, like, well, if y'all got this property donated to y'all, y'all got this property that y'all built this multi-million-dollar institution on donated to y'all, then why are you putting us through all kind of craziness and hopes for vacant, abandoned, and blighted parcels of property that are abandoned to access that to grow our own food on, you know? And so we started to just think about, you know, just like just manifest destiny, you know, and how that happened. I mean, the miseducation of the Negro and all the different layers of, like, you know, this is an education. Like, let's have the education. If we're gonna have the education, let's have the education about access and self-sufficiency and to draw out of people what exists in them, you know, currently, and not a project, you know, that is being done to say that you did something so that you can continue to operate in your current pathology, which is historically and perpetually failed my people. And so obviously that wasn't a good fit, you know, and I didn't go there aspiring for it to not be a good fit. I thought that because in the position description, it outlined that they wanted somebody with a focus in on anti-racism, you know, and anti-bias work. I was like, well, I'm the person for that. I said, I'm that person. I can have the conversation. We can talk about this then, because that's good. I'm at home now. But that's not what it was like. Okay, that's a little too much, sis. No, you know, so I feel like, to answer that question, Michelle, I don't know. I think the type of barriers, like I said, you know, I mean, just the requirements for people to be able to access land. Why, first of all, there's no industry recognized credential for farming. That's number one. And so I felt like the mentality surrounding within the space like that, you know, I set up a project-based learning cohort. And so within the context of that framework of pedagogy, it's like you have a question. You have a challenging question. And then you go through these different layers of this. And at the end of this, you know, there's sustained inquiry. And then there's like, at the end, there's like this public product. And then you like have a space for reflection. And then you have a space for, you know, revision and critique, you know, all of the different layers. And so my vision was that we would, and as someone who's a Black woman who has aspired to do something and wasn't able to scale, I knew that we needed to have a network. I knew early on when we started this that we needed to have a network so that it could be sustainable. And so this idea of these individual farm businesses, I thought that was, yeah, we can do that. And I think that that's important work. And I think that within the context of a network, just by virtue of the fact that we're really talking about food sovereignty and if we're really talking about dismantling poverty or addressing the issue of intergenerational poverty, I felt like just that community space and that Hampton in me, like understanding the layers of like support and how any other community, it's not just Black community in Hampton, I mean, the Jewish community, any other community that's sustainable, I mean, they turn a dollar over how many times? I knew that that was an important component. So I knew that we needed to have our people being able to have these individual farm businesses that were a part of an ecosystem that was sustainable. So I aspire to create that space with that work. And in terms of the accessing of the land, when we weren't able to access land very early on, and all the different, the barriers attached to accessing land because the land isn't appropriately zoned or, you know, the land is just, I mean, the entity that we were going to get the land from, they outlined that they would operate in agreement with us to be able to access land. But then there were stipulations on that. So the land was not going to be released unless the parcels were zoned appropriately for the use that they were going to be utilized for. With the list that they gave us, which again was very late in the cohort experience, the bulk of those properties were zoned residential, and agriculture is a prohibited use in residential spaces. And so residential on vacant lots that are zoned residential, that's a prohibited use. And so that's a barrier. Then it was told to the participants before that, that they had to have business plans in order to be able to access land. And I'm like, they don't got no land. How are they going to make a business plan? Where's the trees at on the property? What property is it? What's the dimensions of the property? Like, what's native to this property? There's too many different layers of things that you can't, in any information and any of the resources that we provided to the participants that I compiled and aggregated for them from the EPA to the USDA, it all says you got to start with the land. You know, you have to have land and then you can participate or you can engage in an urban agriculture initiative or project. And so those were the type of barriers. Just number one, not being able to access land. Why do I think that happened? Well, because I think, again, the way it was told to me, that the way that I was painting the institution was not complimentary to them, you know, and they didn't like that. My direct supervisor said that to me. And so because, like I said, in a part of project-based learning, it was sustained inquiry. And I regularly told the participants, hey, we need to interrogate the systems. I come from the school of thought that we have enough of everything. We need to look internally in terms of how are we failing people with what we currently have? These institutions are built. We helped build them. We don't need to, I do believe in parallel processes and systems, absolutely. But the courthouse is already down there. Just within the context of what these systems are now, let's make that equitable. Let's do a theory of change and do what's right within the context of what exists. That's true humanity. That's true community. And that's the way that I thought I was working within the institution, is to create a conversation. And so I taped all of the different farm talks from the very beginning. We recorded them so that I thought it was going to be like lauded, like my efforts were going to be like, wow, we've never had this level of insight in terms of like how communities of color operate, you know, and how we can think within the context of this institution, how we can shift things to be more supportive, to retain people of color, because this woman has been successful in recruiting a cohort predominantly of people of color. And the content of the conversation is so good, it's quality, that we can use this to inform our processes here. Yay! It was not like that. It was not, they was like, oh, you got, honey, that's not how we're doing things here. And I'm like, what? Like, this is brilliant. Like, this ain't never been done before. And it's like, no. And so now it's like, so when you ask the question, what barriers, those are the barriers, unneeded and unnecessary blocks to be able to access the resources. Number two, I was emphatic that it was a Black person-led initiative, because I could not justify, nor will I ever justify, a white person, specifically a white woman, ever telling me what's best for me and my people. I'm never going to be able to justify that. I'm never going to be able to say that that's the appropriate pathway for us moving. That's just never going to happen. To that point, I don't know how anybody can justify, just considering our history, why that would ever be something that would be expected of a Black woman. And it became very clear to me that the due diligence for that type of work had not been done on several layers. It had not been vetted in the community. I was called a mouthpiece for white people. I was not vetted in the community because I took on the role within the context of that institution. And number two, the institution, specifically whoever put the position description out and whoever allowed for that to happen, had not taken into consideration. I think that one of the biggest things that really was hurtful for me, and I'm not throwing the baby away with the bathwater. I made a comment, and I want to say this out 7 times into the universe, that I will work for an institution. 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 I had made comments that I'm never going to do that again. I will, because that is such an amazing opportunity for those kinds of spaces to be affirming of us organizing in that way. Like, we did it, and right when we could have like really popped off, and that could have been a huge win for us in our community, this new way of doing that and creating space within the context of institutions like this. Oh my gosh, it's powerful, Michelle. It's so powerful. Where it's peer-to-peer learning, where it's, and it's affirmed, because that culturally is affirmative to us. Culturally, that matters to us. Us learning the way that we're talking now and preserving our history, even though we don't remember where we come from and we don't remember if we was born in California or Pennsylvania, we still, we can still, like, us telling our stories, that is important. That's a part of who we are as a people. It's like, that's why I struggle like with public speaking, but I can talk to you because this is what we do. It's like, that's affirming. That's how we learn. That's how we build networks and systems. That can, that needs to happen in institutions. And I am willing to facilitate that process. I can do it. And I'm just saying, like, you can do that. Like, that matters. And I just think that the role of the institution, like, I am starting to, like I said, I am a displaced African American, but I am a citizen. I am an American. That means, like, glean from me, America. Like, I am a, like, resource. Black women are a resource to you. Like, within, like, Michelle, like, look at this woman. Like, glean from Michelle. She knows everything. Like, get you a Black woman. Get you a Black woman in here so you can get this stuff fixed, man. Like, so we can fix that thing, baby. Get you a Black woman in here. That's okay. You institutions need to create space for us to just do our thing so we can fix it. Now, let me come on in there and fix that. It's design science. I can tell you so many stories of people in the cohort. We've had people that, we had a single dad who came in during the context of the cohort. His children's mother, she had twins. And baby, one of his twin sons had open heart surgery. This man brought these babies to school with him every single week. The mom got sick. He cared for those children. He worked a full-time job. He took care of his children. He was, when we first met him, he was working as a cook and he was making teas on the side. And now he has work, he works in this culture. He has an amazing green thumb. He's participating in a worker-owned cooperative. He's amazing. He wants to be the neighborhood root man, the neighborhood herbalist. He's taken herbalism classes at the entity that I'm talking about, which is amazing. He makes elderberry syrup. When this whole thing first started popping off, he said, come over here and get you some elderberry syrup, Remy. You know, all this stuff, like, that's one example. We have a whole entire West Side Market that's going to be coming up over in the west side of town. The Edison neighborhood, there's tower gardens being erected in people's homes where they're harvesting and feeding hundreds of people. You know, I mean, I can't even begin to tell you, people feeding their families, people that have already been doing this work for many, many years, gardening, building raised beds right in front of their homes, in the back of their homes, helping one another, building networks amongst one another, crowdfunding so that they can open up grocery stores. I mean, this is what we're doing. That's what we brought together within the context of that network. And I didn't do it alone. I had to do it within the context of this system that I'm talking about in that community. That's who was in that cohort that I was speaking to. People that, and it's not just Black people, white males, you know, queer women, or, you know, people that have been othered their entire life that said that they have, you know, I've never been able to feel like I belong and I exist and I found community in this space. Or like my food, because I have food sensitivities, like I feel like every single day I make a decision about how I want to live, or even if I will, you know. So being able to have control over how you source your food and participating in that, that's important to many of these people that participated in the cohort, you know, for their own sustainability.
Love has truly been good to me. Not even one sad day or minute have I had since you've come my way. I hope
That issue of poverty, that generational concept of what poverty represents in people's lives, and to be able to interrupt that by owning land and being able to, I mean, for that to have been disrupted, it's number one, it's sinful, but the hope of what it represents for people even outside of that space, because the, you know, we can't stop, we won't stop. That still is an option, and it needs to continue to be an option, because outside of the institution, that still is a pathway out of poverty. There's economic benefit, there's ecological benefits, there's social benefits and implications. The one way that we can start to regenerate, have regenerative agriculture, is to work side by side with the people that have bastardized, historically have bastardized the land, so that we can start reforming and rebuilding a narrative and relationship with one another, so that we all eating from this land right here, we gonna all from the sweat of our brow together, we can make something happen. Because we're doing it together on this land. So yeah, we've inherited some things, and how you atone for that, sis, I don't know what to tell you, but that's between you and your God. But I'm saying, for now, in terms of the story we trying to create together, we can eat by this food right here, this sweat of our brow together, we can restory that right now. We can eat from this land together, and we can do it side by side. That's a social benefit, you know? And I mean, I don't know where we late. We late to the party. That's the answer. That's the answer. That's why I said that y'all could, I will work for an institution. I'm going to work. I will see how that looks. But I have, I opened up the community design studio, and I purchased 3 parcels of property. So, I mean, you didn't ask me about all the advocacy work and all the other stuff that happened. So when the participants weren't able to get access to land, I went and bought some land. When they said that the zoning won't go work out, I went and advocated at downtown for our participants and for myself to be able to get zoning, you know, regulated. So we're still in the process of, or to be, of that to be an allowable use, still working within that, still trying to do advocacy work about that. Surrounding that, and we have Zoo City Farm and Food Network. And so we, on these parcels of property, we have to go next month to the Zoning Board of Appeals so that we can get a use variance for this. But we're doing the work on cooperative, and people can come in. I'm only going to do 12 shares in this worker-owned cooperative, and the majority owners of this worker-owned cooperative have got to be Black women. And so I'm hoping that'll be, you know, we can do it that way. It'll be great. But it's a matriarchal, culturally autonomous kind of a situation where we want everybody to participate and everybody to participate. So if you got your own land, that's fine. Anybody can come and do that and participate in the network. But for this particular, just by virtue of where it's at and where it's situated, the majority of people that own that in that worker-owned cooperative needs to be Black women, because again, that's the face of poverty in this community, and we trying to interrupt and disrupt pathology of poverty in our people and in Black women and our children. We want to create something new, so that's what we're doing with that. And that's it. I'm still doing my art stuff, and the most important thing, I'm being Tegan's mama, and that is a full-time job, and that is my love and my baby, and I love her so much, and I'm, you know, homeschooling her and just all the things that I set out to do, I'm doing it. And it's funny how it all came back around. And I know God's going to be glorified, because I know, Michelle, I'm telling you, like, I got so many ideas, you know that, but it's going to be good. I think it's all going to work out. You know, they feel amazing. So they're in the Edison neighborhood. That's where I started my career, at the Boys and Girls Club in Edison. And I feel deeply connected to that neighborhood. I feel a deep responsibility. Most of the kids and families that I knew, a lot of them still live there. You know, I still know a lot of people there, but many of them have grown up and they're not kids anymore. But I made some promises that I was going to do some stuff, and I do what I say I'm going to do. And when it all pops off, when all the things that I believe are that God has for me, and the things that I view my future, the things that I've envisioned, art and growing and community building and opportunities for people, they're gonna be like, Miss Remy, she she's a real one, because she said, and it took some decades, but sis did it, you know. and I believe in my people. I love my people. They're in the Edison neighborhood. When I love strong and hard. I don't change up. And it's there. It's in Edison. It's on, one's on Washington, one's on Mills, and one's on Jackson Street. The properties are there. And number one, they feel amazing. They feel like regenerative agriculture can be done there. I'm looking into ways to do that, to create and spark biodiversity so that we're pouring into the land in a way that is, you know, there's going to be some row farming, but there's going to be a lot of permaculture. I'm hoping some native stuff happening there too. I was on a talk last week, and one of the women on the talk is for Black women and growing, and it's amazing. Or it's actually like women of color, all women of color, Latinx, all of us, like we were all on this call. And one of the women said, listen, you don't have to get too deep about it. Just take some seeds and throw it on the land, and the land will tell you what it wants to grow. And I was like, yes, that's it. I was like, I ain't even got to get all, you know how I can get about stuff. If y'all take a handful of seeds and throw it out there and just say, what you want to grow, land? Like, let the land do it. That's how the land feel. I'm going to take some stuff and go throw it out there and just let it be what it is.
Well, this, as always, I just like fall deeper and deeper in admiration for you. your expression, your spirit, your commitment, your vision, you know, all of it. I feel really honored to be witness to you telling your story again and again, because I tell me again, you know.
Michelle.
Imagine if all the rappers were to get with all the athletes, our activists and actors for a conference in Zaire to meet with all the ambassadors in the motherland. Tell them we're coming back for her, America. Know if we leave, it'd be a massacre. Zimbabwe would be full of.
Thanks for listening in on our syncopate conversation with Remy Harrington. You can hear other parts of the series on WMBM Radio on Live 365, 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time during July and starting in August on Podbean. Remy can be found at one of three Zoo City Farm and Network urban farming sites in Kalamazoo's Southside Edison neighborhood. The Syncopate intro and outro music is by CC Beats, and Raising Hay intro and outro music is by Chickwood Beats, and the project is mixed and edited by C3 Media and Production. Remy Harrington co-curated her story's musical selections and added Feel It in the Air by Beanie Siegel, Fight the Power by Public Enemy, Redhead Kingpin 321 Pump, Luther Vandross So Amazing, and Sci Hi the Prince New Africa. You've been listening to Syncopate, the groove just on the other side of the beat. I'm DJ Disobedience, aka Dr. Michelle S. Johnson. We hope your landscape looks richer with Black history and your commitment to restoring Black spaces is deepened. Let Black joy become your anthem and fill the space around you. I'd like to thank C3 Media and Production, creative visual and audio storytelling, RB Productions, WMBM Radio, and the Arts Council of Kalamazoo for their generous support of this project.